Hello, welcome to Radio Plays, the interview sessions. My name is Sean M. Dale, and we are here chatting today with the amazing and wonderful Mark Oristano, along with Kara Limer. How's everybody doing today?
Great. Yeah. Just thanks. Hanging out, waiting for you to call.
Yeah, sweet.
Right.
We're glad you answered.
That's right. I'll let Kara kick off the first round of questions. We'll just bounce back and forth. I hope you're ready to be bombarded.
Yeah, cool.
I'll take playwriting for 200.
Yeah, perfect. So we're chatting with Mark, who is the playwright for The Impact of Gadget on Civilization. So tell us, Mark, a little bit about how you first got started as a playwright and just kind of about your path as a professional.
How I got started as a playwright. Wow. I was kidnapped by gypsies when I was about 16. No. I mean, I've always loved the theater. My first exposure to the theater, I was like 7 years old, and my parents took me to see The Music Man on Broadway with Robert Preston and Barbara Cook. And I was just, you know, blown away by it. And I was sat there thinking, I want to do what those guys are doing. And, as I started as an actor later on, having grown up, I had written a lot of other stuff. I'd written a lot of newspaper and magazine articles during my work as a sportscaster for 30 years. And I just came up with an idea one day for a play and approached another writer who was also a lawyer, because it was a play that had a legal aspect to it. And I said, you want to work on this? And we did. And it was eventually done by a theater in Fort Worth called Stage West. It was not, this was 30 something years ago. And I found the script the other day and read about the first 10 pages of it and threw it aside because it was so bad. I didn't want to look at it.
I don't buy
but,
it.
No, it was bad. It really was. But that was the beginning. And then since then, I've written, I don't know, 5 or 6 others, a couple of which have been produced, including this one. And so I'm just, you know, anything for poverty. Here we go.
That's right. Cool. So what about your inspiration for writing this play? What inspired you to write this particular piece?
Well, this play, the basis of the play is that it's 1945. And in Los Alamos, New Mexico, there is a project being undertaken by the government called the Manhattan Project. By far the most secret project the United States has ever undertaken. It was the project that developed the atomic bomb. And initially, the project was to counter Germany because they were afraid that the Germans were going to get a bomb. And it was run by a scientist, a physicist named Robert Oppenheimer. And Oppenheimer and Albert Einstein had been acquainted and had worked together a little bit at Berkeley back in the 30s. And so the basis of the play is that Einstein wangles an invitation into Los Alamos to see Oppenheimer, and he tries to convince him to make the bomb a dud. To convince Oppenheimer to make sure the bomb won't work, to ensure a little more world peace and not put the cloud of nuclear war over the world. Totally made up, never really happened. Einstein never went to Los Alamos. But what it came from, the inspiration for it, the Einstein story is a part of my family history, because my maternal grandfather, a man named Herbert Maas, was a high-powered Wall Street lawyer from the 20s through the 40s into the 50s. And he was one of the people responsible for bringing Einstein to America to escape Nazi Germany in the early 30s.
Amazing.
And he was also one of the founders of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, not connected with the university, but located in Princeton, which is the world famous think tank where world famous scientists just come and sit at a desk and think. And Einstein spent the last 20 years of his life there. And in fact, my grandfather was the president of the Institute at the time when Einstein was working there and Oppenheimer was the director. So this whole story has been wrapped up in my family for years. So what happened? I don't remember what brought me to write the play. I was reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Einstein, which is like this thick, and it's fascinating. It's an amazing book if you ever want to read about Einstein. And I just popped into my head one day, what would have happened if he tried to, you know, he didn't like the bomb. He didn't like war. Who likes war? He was a pacifist.
Yeah.
And what would have happened if he tried to convince Einstein, hey, you know, you shouldn't do this. This is not good. And I sat down and started writing, and I must have read 10 other books about Einstein and Oppenheimer, one of which was called Oppenheimer and Einstein, another great dual biography. And it came together. And I was fairly pleased with it. We did a couple of readings of it here in Dallas, where I live. And then I ran into Kara at a Shakespeare performance in Shakespeare in the Park in Dallas. And that must have been in 2019 because it was pre-pandemic. and we were all actually outside together. And I said, oh, I have this play you might be interested in. And here we are.
So theoretically, it would have been possible that based on your grandfather's connections and how they worked, where they all worked in the same building, that they would have had significant interactions with each other.
Oh, sure.
Oppenheimer and Einstein and even your grandfather.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, my younger brother got a tour, a VIP tour of the Institute a few years ago because he's a relative of one of the founders. And they gave him a trove of copies of documents, including a lot of my grandfather's letters to Oppenheimer, talking about how difficult it was to keep Einstein away from the media because he always wanted to go talk to the press and say things they didn't like and things like that. Really interesting. But it was, I can actually also still remember, this popped into my head, whenever we would visit my grandmother's apartment in New York, there was a framed photograph, silver framed photograph of Einstein inscribed to my grandfather, Herbert Maas, with great respect, A. Einstein. We have no idea what happened to it or where it wound up after my grandmother died, wow. But I wish I knew.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But so that's the family aspect.
Your brother's gotten to tour the Institute, but you haven't been up there, right?
No, but they have invited me, and I certainly want to go. What would really be cool, of course, is to get it produced at some place in Princeton. So we'll see about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Princeton, tune in.
And there was one, speaking about getting it produced other places, I sent a copy of it. There's a little theater group in Los Alamos, and I got in contact with one of the people there, and I sent them a script. And they sent it back, and they didn't like it at all from a literary point of view, and they criticized all of my science. And I wound up looking at talking to some physicists, and they were right. They all their scientific criticism was valid. They don't know anything about how to put a show on because they don't understand drama. But all of their scientific stuff was valid, and I made all those changes in the script. So thank you to them.
Yeah, that's a good segue into my next question, which is what your research process was like for Gadget. You already mentioned reading the biography, dual biography.
Biographies, obviously perusing everything I could find on the internet. I think if you actually counted the words in the play, probably 20% of the dialogue for each of the people, Einstein and Oppenheimer, are words they actually said or wrote.
Yeah,
because especially Einstein was an incredibly prolific writer and a really, really good one. And but it was just every time I went to, the best thing about research is it's like being when you're on YouTube, you're watching a video and you're really enthralled. But then on the right hand side, there's all those other videos and you keep punching through all the other ones and spend 3 hours. Every book I read or every site I saw led me to something else. And so there was a great chain, a concatenation of this to this to this to this. Because there is so much about, especially about Einstein. I mean, Time Magazine said he was the single most important person of the 20th century, which is probably true. And so it was just a very fortuitous thing to write about somebody who is so public, I guess, it's all out there.
So Einstein and Oppenheimer would have known each other at the Institute, correct? Is there much documentation about kind of their relationship after the war or anything? Did they remain friends?
Yes, in the book Oppenheimer and Einstein, also in the book, there's a great biography of Oppenheimer called American Prometheus. They were friends, and they weren't college students. They didn't do research together. But they were friends, and they had their own opinions about the war and what had happened and what was wrong and what was right. But they first met back in the early 30s. Oppenheimer was teaching at Berkeley, and Einstein was lecturing there. And they became friends and corresponded and all the way to the end of Einstein's life in the 50s.
That is cool. That's wild. It makes the play even more impactful knowing that the relationship they at least had was real, and everything that you're describing about, their interactions with each other and how they were friends would absolutely open up for this type of dialogue to have happened,
Yeah.
There is no, I don't think there's any hint anywhere that any kind of discussion like this ever happened it never happened at Los Alamos because Einstein wasn't invited, but, that it happened, that they ever talked about it anywhere. After the war was over, Oppenheimer was very forthcoming about the fact that he thought he'd done the wrong thing. In fact, he was meeting with President Truman in the White House after the war, and he told Truman, he said, "I have blood on my hands." And Truman looked at him and said, "You have blood on your hands? I'm the one who dropped the damn thing." And he had the he said he had him thrown out. He said, "Don't ever let that guy back in the White House." So, you know, he regretted what he did, and he was at one point they took his security clearance away. He had his life after it was not all that pleasant. Whereas Einstein was, you know, the favorite uncle hero of the world for all his life.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. For one thing, like just kind of pinging off of everything that we've been saying, just talking about that relationship that exists between them, something that I love so much about the play is that, you know, there's a lot of arguments happening back and forth. It's a very, you know, sort of intellectual, heady play. But because you have that relationship and that connection and that, you know, emotional investment in it, it has the heart in it, too. That's something that really comes out in it. And yeah, when I first read your script, the thing that I really appreciated about it right from the first is how there are balanced arguments coming through the eyes of both characters throughout the play. Mm. You know, it's very well balanced. You can see it from through both people's eyes. Is that something that was intentional when you were crafting it?
Oh, I think from a dramatic standpoint, it has to be, because if you put Muhammad Ali in the ring with a 6-year-old, it's not going to be much of a fight. You have to have an antagonist who is at least the equal of the protagonist, or it's going to be really, really dull. And the basis of drama, of course, Mike Nichols, the great director, once said, if you have somebody walk out on stage and say white, you better have somebody else walk out and say black real quick, or I'm going to be bored.
Yeah.
So once I had read enough of both of their writings about the subject, I realized that they both did have very valid points. And it's tough for us to sit in 2022 and look back to 1945 and say, you know, every day thousands of families were getting those telegrams saying that their sons had been killed.
Yeah.
What? How would we have felt? I mean, just as a total side point, my mother, who is Jewish, would never ride in a German-made automobile.
Wow.
So, you know, it's hard for us to understand these kind of things, but yeah. There were, I mean, Oppenheimer was called by his country, and he felt a duty to do it, and he said he got caught up in the science of it and not the morality of it until very late. And the fact the title of the play, the original title was Einstein, Oppenheimer, God, because I thought that was the physics pecking order. But I changed it because that title, the impact of the gadget on civilization, late in the development of the bomb, they had several scientists came to Oppenheimer and said, we're not really sure this is a good idea. We need to talk about what's going to happen with this thing when we've made it. And so they had a meeting called the impact of the gadget on civilization, because they never called it a bomb. At Los Alamos, it was called the gadget, which was like a psychological way of saying, okay, we're not really making something that's going to kill a lot of people. We're making a new can opener, you know? Mm-hmm. We're making a better mousetrap. So the title comes from that, because I thought it was just such a great, great line, the impact of the gadget on civilization.
Yeah.
So when you were writing this piece, did you find yourself identifying more with any particular character?
Well, I tried not to, because I wanted it to be balanced. I mean, obviously, from a pure me standpoint, I identify more with Einstein because I hate war, and I think that it's terrible, and I think that you can't, if you have science's soul to the highest bidder, it's not science anymore, it's business. Mm-hmm. And so Kara said, they both had good arguments, but my personal preference would probably be with Einstein.
Yeah.
If I had to bet.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be actually very curious to know, like, of our listeners, which way they leaned towards or which arguments they, you know, tended to gravitate towards.
Well, you always hope that your writing will be relevant. Unfortunately, this has become relevant because we now have a horrible war going on in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And we are having, as a nation, to be very guarded and careful that we don't do something that's going to lead to the use of these weapons in a war.
Yeah.
Oh, they're out there.
Yeah, that's what's been interesting about this process is that, you know, the whole idea of living in the shadow of nuclear warfare and all of that, you know, with that threat. I mean, I've never known life without it, you know. I mean, most of us haven't, you know. That's just something that you've always known. But how much it's been brought to the forefront recently. And it's crazy because we actually recorded this play, and we started recording this play back in August. Last year, you know. So it's crazy
Well, and you know, I'm, because I'm, how should I say this nicely, significantly older than both of you, I can remember the last time there was a really grave nuclear threat that hung over the world was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, yeah. when the Soviets put nuclear missiles in Cuba and the Kennedy administration forced them to back down. There was tremendous worry all through the country that we were going to go to nuclear war with the Russians. And we did. I can remember being in, I was in, I guess, fifth grade, and we did those duck and cover drills where we got under our desk. And I remember in fifth grade, I'm thinking, what, this, my desk is going to stop a bomb?
Yeah.
Seriously?
What is this going to do?
We're really doing, right? This is great protection.
Yeah.
So, you know, I remember that cloud very well. And it's a mushroom cloud, and it's really ugly. And please God, let's don't ever see it again.
Yeah. Well, I had the joy of directing this play. And I mean, I was only a few pages into reading it before I started reading Oppie's voice in your voice, Mark. So I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it. It was just, he was a New Yorker. You're a New Yorker. It seemed like it was something that had to be. So what was it like to act in your own play? And have you ever done this before?
Well, I've done it in a different sense. Your reaction was exactly the opposite of what most playwrights go through, which is the worst moment of playwriting is the first time that you hear somebody else delivering your lines out loud, because they never sound like they do in your head. I will say that Robin's voice was as close to that I actually heard as Einstein, a kind of folksy, but you know, gruff and pointed when he had to be, but. It really wasn't too bad doing this because I spent 30 years in radio, and so speaking into a microphone is really not acting for me. But I did do, for about 10 years, I did a one-man show called And Crown Thy Good, which I wrote, which is a true story of my experiences surrounding 9/11, a very spiritual kind of story. But so again, that's not really acting because I was up on stage being me. I was myself.
Right.
And I had to, it was done with our great good friend, the late Rene Moreno was the director. So it was a labor of love. And, I couldn't play Oppenheimer on stage for real because he was much younger at this point than I am. So I wouldn't do it. But, it was okay. It wasn't that bad. I got through it. I still, when I listen to it, I kind of go, oh, geez. How could you say that line that way?
Yeah, that's a very accurate thing.
Sure, because you always, you know, I can understand why movie actors say they don't want to look at their shows, because all you do is see the stuff you would have done differently.
Right.
Yes.
And so, you know, my daughter is a television and film actor. She hates to watch herself.
Yeah.
And I tell her, she said, you were great in that scene. Oh, no, but look, I turned the wrong way and my head was tilted. And, you know, we're all picky. We're all picky.
Well, you and Robin were fantastic.
When it comes to wearing different hats, right, actor, director, writer, producer, is there one that you tend to identify with first and foremost? And what are some notable differences and similarities between acting and writing?
Well, writing is obviously very solitary. When you're writing, you are essentially playing God. You decide who the characters are. You decide what they say, what they do, when they live, when they die. So it's a very insular process that you then, once you're done, have to like give birth to it and put it out before the world. And as I said, the first time you hear people speak the words, it's very difficult. Then you go through a rehearsal process with the actors where you have to remember time and time again that you had years doing all your rewrites as a writer. In rehearsal, that's where the actors are doing their rewriting, and you can't mess with their process. You have to let them experiment and do what they want to do. But if I had to pick the one hat, it would be as an actor. Acting is much more fun than writing because you're around other people and it's communal. And if I remember, it's been so long since I've done it because of the pandemic, but it's more enjoyable. I mean, writing is fun, and it's rewarding in a sense. But the great line that I remember who said it was, "I'm not a writer, I'm a rewriter." Because, I mean, the changes that went through this script and at the end of this script, at the end of this play, Oppenheimer and Einstein engage in a roll of dice, in a dice game, to decide whose argument will carry. And if Einstein wins, Oppenheimer's going to make sure the bomb is a dud. And if Oppenheimer wins, Einstein will go away. Originally, they were going to play a chess game. I had them playing chess because they played a famous chess game in 1933 in which Einstein whipped Oppenheimer. But that was too slow. It was just, you know, the plotting of the moves. It just didn't work well. And purely by happenstance, I saw in a newspaper article the basis of the dice game that I wound up using in the piece. It was a mathematical puzzle. And I threw it into the story, and it worked perfectly. So it's just one of those things that, thank you, somebody's looking out for me. I appreciate it.
And I mean, it creates such a powerful moment there, yeah. Because when you have the two of them going back and forth, rolling the dice, and then, you know, you hear the explosions in the background. It's like, it really hits home what is actually being conveyed through just the simple act of rolling dice.
Mm. Yep. Yep. And there's also the famous quote from Einstein, which was, it was translated as saying, God doesn't play dice with the universe, but he didn't really say that. He said, I don't believe he rolls dice. And he was talking about quantum mechanics, which is, I don't even understand. My younger brother, who I talked about before, was a physics major in college. So he understands all this stuff like nobody's business. And he gave me a lot of insight in this as to how I had to do things. But Einstein said, I don't believe he plays dice. He's not that random. So that's why the dice game also has a double meaning for some people.
Yeah.
I do want to ask, actually, I'm going to throw this over to you, Karen, because, you know, speaking of wearing a lot of different hats, you have mostly played the actor here. And so what was the process like for you coming in as a director on this piece and working with, you know, your friend Mark, and just, yeah, what was your experience like with that?
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, this was a great one to be my first one. And I, like I said, I have no idea what it's like to be a director with either a script that you might not have picked or a cast that you might not feel comfortable with. I can't imagine doing it, because Gadget grabbed me within the first few pages, and it was literally like, oh my gosh, we have to do this. This is so good. I mean, I was just gripped, and it was one of those that I couldn't put it down. So there was no question in my mind. I mean, I just immediately resonated with it and was like, oh yes, this is it. I have to do it. And then pretty similarly with casting, Robin and Mark were my first choices for both. I mean, it you know, like I said, immediately it was like, oh, like I don't know. I was reading Oppie in Mark's voice, and I was scared he was going to say no. I was like, oh, because we've never had a playwright voice one of their roles on here before. So I didn't, and I'm not a writer at all. So I had no idea if he would say yes or not. But so I was delighted whenever he did say yes. And to bring in a European to be Einstein's voice, Mark said, like, just folksy, you know, whatever. I don't know. There was something that I was like, oh, Robin would be really good for this. And I was pretty sure that they would have excellent just chemistry together. And of course they did. And I feel, as the director, like if you have a brilliant script and you have brilliant actors, then your job's super easy and fun, you know? Yep. So, it was a delight all the way through.
Well, I mentioned a few moments ago, Rene Moreno, the director, who you and I both were in, yes, Romeo and Juliet with Rene at Shakespeare Dallas. And I did 14 shows with him. I mean, he was my best friend.
Amazing.
But I assume that you saw in working with him his absolute 100% belief that everything you needed to know was in the text.
Yes.
And that you had to dig down and find out. There were many, many times when Rene was a paraplegic, he was in a wheelchair, and he would stop rehearsal and he would roll over to you in his chair and he would get very quiet and he'd say, why did you say that line there? And I would always say, well, it's in the script. I have to say, but no, I say, no, why? Why did the playwright give you those words at that moment? And he really made you dig down and find out what the heck you were talking about.
Yes.
And I'm sure that you translated some of that into this and into whatever directing you do next.
Yeah, 100%.
He gave us all a lot.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's such a valuable tip for actors too. It's something that I think most of us forget in the moment of rehearsing, but it's so incredibly valuable to just look at the text, write down, you know, all the who's, what's, when's, and where's, and what people are saying and all that kind of stuff, just to know exactly what's being said.
Yeah.
That's so important.
Yeah. It was fun in this process, because with some of our scripts that are, you know, written for stage, there's certain edits and things that have to be done, or, you know, slight shifts and things like that to make it translate to audio, you know, sometimes, and or kind of talk about sound effects or whatever. And that, you know, for all of the ones that we've done up to this point, it was always something that we did with the playwright you know, kind of outside of rehearsal. And it was fun with this one because like Mark was already there in rehearsal. So we were just like, you know, stuff as we went along, he was like, oh, no, you know, change it to that. Say that instead or whatever. So,
yeah, well, that's the other side. You know, it's terrible when you hear people say your lines for the first time. But then when you get past that ego thing, you hear, oh, wow, you know, that word, that's not the right word there. I mean, it sounded right when I was typing, but it's not right. And you have to go back and say, no, change that. It's either that the actor's not getting it across, or I chose the wrong word, or it's a very subtle process, and it's a lot of fun because it is all experimental.
Yeah.
I mean, you're guessing.
Were there any moments during the rehearsal process where it was the other way around, where you heard a line or there was a moment or something that happened for the first time and you thought, oh, no, that works. That's perfect. That's the way it needs to be.
Yeah, I'm sure there were. And I'm sure most of them were from Einstein because I was too busy, you know, listening to my own voice. But Robin found, as I said, the perfect folksy grandfather level to play Einstein at. And so it made so much sense. I think probably most of what sounded good to me was the humor, because Einstein was a very funny man.
Yes.
And, you know, there's the very famous picture of him sticking his tongue out at the camera, you know, which not many famous scientists would do that. And so the humor, which you have to have, you can't have an hour of pure intellectual garbage because people go nuts. And all the jokes landed for me, which was good.
There's such a well-balanced pacing between both of the characters. Mm-hmm. Like, you can hear that, and it really creates this beautiful dance of dialogue, you know, that you both get to have.
A lot of that, what that comes from is to go back to say, you know, you have to look at the text. Oppenheimer was extraordinarily busy. He was working 18 to 20 hour days for 3 years. He had gone down. He weighed about 110 pounds by the time the bomb was actually tested. He was chain smoking 3 and 4 packs of cigarettes a day. He didn't have time to sit there and go through a lot of lengthy discussions. He did it because it was Albert Einstein. There was no one else in the world that he would have that discussion with, even anybody who was there working on the project.
Yeah.
But this is Albert Einstein. Wow. Everybody was starstruck by Einstein, including Oppenheimer. But the pace, the thing about playwriting that you really, I think the first thing you have to have is you better be able to write good dialogue, because that's what it all is.
Yeah.
You need to write, you can't write stuffy, pedantic BS, because the audience is going to say, oh, no, I don't want to. Or, you know, have Einstein speak German and Oppenheimer speak English. That'd be exciting.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to write the way people talk, and not just the way people talk, but the way those specific people talk.
Yeah. A dance is a good way to describe it. I found myself just getting lost in that. And I, Sean, you said the same thing on editing. You start listening to it and you just immediately find yourself lost in that. It's almost like, what? That was already, like, where'd that time go? Did you get lost in, like, the arguments and everything? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The dance. It's
like probably one of the easiest and most enjoyable editing processes I've ever done with one of these projects, you know. Just, it was fun to listen to every time.
Yeah.
I'm glad it was, but I don't think I have many more of these type plays in me. So this is probably my one great historical piece.
Hey, you never know when that.
Well, that's true.
You know, bam.
You just and you also, when the inspiration hits, you have to look at it too and say, what is this, a book? Is this a screenplay? Is this a stage play? And this to me was always a stage play, because it's just the interesting kind of play that I love. Interesting, intelligent people having conversations that are important. I mean, I love The Music Man. I did 15 musicals for a big theater here in Dallas called Lyric Stage. I love musicals, but this theater of intelligent discussion is my favorite. Glengarry, Glenn Ross, you know, things like that.
Amazing. It reminds me of that play, 12 Angry Men. It was that dialogue that was so intelligent of, like, what do we do in presenting all these different angles? And I loved that kind of.
Well, that was Patty Chayefsky, one of the greatest playwrights of all time, who later wrote a little film called Network, which came out when I was at the height of my television career in 1976. And I watched that movie and I thought, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. This could never happen. It's all come true. Everything he predicted in that movie has happened. So he was one of the best ever, by far.
Are there any upcoming plans for Gadget, or are you working on any other projects at the moment?
I'm working on other projects. I always have something writing. I'm writing detective novels right now, actually, set in Scotland.
Brilliant.
But, nice. Gadget is, we already had done, I think I told you about this, we did a streaming video of it during the height of the pandemic with a theater company here in Dallas, and T.A. Taylor, who you remember from Romeo and Juliet, played Einstein. But it was not edited as well as it should have been and things, and it didn't work as well. Obviously, I would like to see it done on stage. I mean, I'd love to see it done. If anybody in London is watching and you have a theater, I would love to work with you. Call me.
Heck yes.
Please, call me.
So remind us where you're currently based and where people can keep up with your work.
I am right here. I'm in Dallas, where I've been since 1970. Totally blissfully out of left field, wind up meeting Kara, who I hadn't seen for 5 years. And, oh, we have a theater company where we do radio plays. Oh, I have a play you might be interested in. So that's how it happened. And it's really just, it's not totally left to chance. And I do have some contacts in other theaters, but it's, you know, getting a theater company to put something on your schedule, you're talking about nearly 2 years down the road. So it's a long way away, and it's a tough business, and it's changed so much because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
That, you know, theater companies are doing all kinds of different weird things now. I mean, some company's going to come to me and say, we want to do your show, but we want to have Einstein played by a woman. No, you don't. No. Sorry. Not going to happen.
Not the right play.
No. No. So I keep doing what I can. I'll shout. I'll let you know. I'll send you an email if I'm doing something interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I'm absolutely looking forward to those detective novels. Good excuse to go back to Scotland, too.
They're about a New York detective whose wife gets murdered, and it's all tied in with the mob, and he decides he's going to leave New York and go back to Inverness, Scotland, where he and his wife honeymooned 10 years before, try and forget about it. And he winds up investigating murders with the police Scotland. So
love it. Inverness
it's
is
fun.
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful town.
Yeah.
I love it.
Brilliant.
It's an excuse to visit there. I have to go visit again so I can get location information.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Research, inspiration,
yes.
All
research.
The things. Yeah.
Research, research. So that's about the sum of what I'm doing.
Yeah, cool. Excellent.
And your photography as well. I creeped a little bit on your Instagram, and I was like, okay.
Yeah, I do a little bit on there. I don't do as much as I used to do because I really am concentrating on writing now. The only other thing that I do regularly, I have a very nice gig with Celebrity Cruise Lines, where I go out on cruises and I do football lectures because I used to be a football broadcaster for the Dallas Cowboys back when they were winning, so that's you know, I get to travel all around, and that's really cool. But that has nothing to do with theater or writing or anything. But
Dallas, America's team. You know?
Yes. Yes.
America's team.
Well, I'm sure they'd trade that title. Oh, a Denver fan. Okay. Well, then we'll.
For that.
We have to be careful here. We don't want to lose the theater audience talking about football.
That's true. You didn't hear anything here, but I'm going to leave some of this in.
Okay. I love it. Pinging it back to the theater crowd.
Okay.
To take us out, do you have any advice that you might have for writers or even just artists in general who are just starting out?
Yes. Don't do it. No.
Leave immediately.
But the best answer I can give to that is when my daughter was just beginning her theater career in New York, we were having dinner with some friends of mine, and one of them asked her, there's so much rejection, there's so much negativity, it's so hard to get work, why do you do it? And she just said, I can't imagine doing anything else with my life. And that's the best answer I've ever heard. It has to be a passion, and you have to, if you only get your work done in a black box theater in front of 10 people, that has to be enough. Mm-hmm. You really have to want to do it and love to do it and sacrifice for it. And just, you know, keep on typing till your fingers wear to the bone, or keep on rehearsing and auditioning, and just, you got to love it. If you don't love it, don't do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Good advice.
Absolutely. That's great advice.
I love it.
Next time I hear someone complain, I'm going to be like, look, why do you do what you do? All right. So you can get your butt out there and you do it for those five people because that's what you were born to do.
Well, you know, it was the great jazz pianist, Oscar Peterson, years ago, they were he and his trio were going out onto the stage for a performance in a jazz club, and the bass player said, there's only about 20 people here tonight. We can just put it on cruise control. And Oscar looked at him and said, you put it on cruise control when we're rehearsing? He said, no. He said, how many people are there when we're rehearsing? None. He said, all right, don't put it on cruise control now, pal.
Mm.
Every performance is the same.
Nice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm going to go listen to some of that now. I love jazz.
There's one album, like, what is it, Night Train?
Oh, yeah.
Is that one of the, such a good album. It's so good. Yeah.
Yes.
Shameless plug for that album because it's just tremendous. For the impact of Gadget on civilization, you can stream it on our Radio Plays podcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, or you can also access it on our website at www.borderlesstheatercompany.com.
Mark, it's been great having you here on the show, you know, to do our interview sessions with Radio Plays, and we cannot wait for people to listen to this interview and for them to keep going back and listening to Gadget and just to see where this whole thing goes from here. It's going to be very exciting.
Thank you both. It's been very enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
All right.
Yeah. Bye.